responsibility for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week we'll bring you additional coverage from the Democratic National Convention with AFGE National President J. David Cox, Save the Children Senior Vice President Mark Shriver, and former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Weiner. But first, AFGE Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel joins us. Dale, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Dale, a recent GAO report titled Bureau of Prisons, Growing Inmate Crowding Negatively Affects Inmates, Staff, and Infrastructure put the BOP overcrowding issue under the spotlight. What did this report find?
It found what we've been seeing for the last 6-7 years, that we have a crisis in this country with overcrowding of prisons in the federal system. More inmates are coming in every year, and we have less and less place to put them, and we don't have infrastructure anymore. We haven't added any new prisons. We only have four, I think, in the books that are to be opened between now and 2015. So we have a definite crisis of where to put these people.
What were some of the statistics that the report found? How much are the facilities over capacity?
The report said it's 39% overcrowded at this point. We have always argued it was higher, but at least we have some confirmation that we do have overcrowding that is beyond what the agency has been claiming or been trying to say, that we were adequately funded and adequately housing the correct amount of inmates and could adequately care for them and that sort of thing.
As someone who works inside a facility, and you represent folks around the country who work inside the facilities, you obviously have a unique perspective on this issue. What makes you think that the numbers are even higher than what the report might suggest?
The people that are working in these prisons see it every day. They see their workload increase. They see their stress levels increase. They see more inmates that have to be fed and cared for. They see more people on their work details. They see more people using the infrastructure of the prisons, the rec yard, the commissary, the facilities inside the dormitories and inside the cell blocks. They see it every day. And the thing that people, the younger people that are coming in, the new people that are coming in, may not recognize it as much as the people that have been there and seen the increase over the years. Those are the people that really notice it.
So being overcrowded by at least 39%, more in your opinion, suggests that these facilities are simply bursting at the seams. Most people might think, okay, so prisoners are triple bunked or double bunked, what have you. What does that mean for me? But a facility that is overcrowded by that much becomes a public safety issue, doesn't it?
No question, because it's harder to monitor their movement. It's hard to monitor the amount of inmates inside the housing unit. Who are they talking to? Who are they conversing with? Who are they spending time with? What are they talking about? What are they planning? The people that come in and visit, we haven't changed the way we do the visits. We still allow people to come face-to-face, personal visits. So it's increasingly harder to monitor anything that's coming in as far as contraband is concerned. And any kind of conversation or communication, we have to spend hours on to listen to see if there's anything going on that may be going coming in from the outside, or some kind of plot for escape, or some kind of plot for while someone's out on a medical trip or what have you. It's just a constant danger, and it's increasing because it's harder to track all of the movement and all of the conversations that are going on. Now the agency has given them email access, and so, I mean, it's just hard to monitor this many people.
And this certainly poses a grave danger to folks like you who serve as correctional officers working in the facilities, right?
No question. We were outnumbered before. now we're 39% more outnumbered. So if we were dealing with 100 inmates on an evening shift, now we're dealing with 139. You know, so yes, it's ever increasing. And because of 2005, the initiative of Mission Critical, we lost officer posts, and so we have less people being able to monitor these inmates, and now we have more inmates. So it's going the wrong way on both ends.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Dale Desotel, the president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Dale, give the audience a sense for what that danger is really like in a prison where correctional officers are unarmed and essentially only equipped with a body alarm radio to alert someone if there's trouble. Give the audience a sense for what it's really like to be in that prison.
It depends totally upon the skills that the officer has. Most officers are skilled with working with inmates, and they talk to them as much as possible, and they try to get a feel for what's going on. But that stress level, to get that done, and then to try to maintain some kind of order and try to do what we call monitor what they're bringing into the units and what they're taking out, what they're hiding, or they trying to hide weapons, the time that we have to shake downs, what we call, and find these weapons or find any kind of contraband is cut extremely by the time we get to talk to these people and monitor their movements in and out. The stress level is off the chain. These officers are totally stressed out to get everything that the agency wants us to do done in that period of time, in that daily hour. Then when something does go wrong or when something does happen, if there's a fight between inmates, then there's really an issue because there's only one person to respond and less people responding than there was years ago. So it's a constant stress factor on how to maintain order and how to maintain and do the job of a correctional officer. It's less and less available to do the correctional work that we need to do.
Dale, on your website, you track inmate on officer assaults, and the statistics that you were able to find through the reporting of your locals suggests that the rate at which inmates assault officers with a weapon has increased every year since at least 2008, which you have on your website. Talk about that for a minute and the dangers of inmates getting weapons to assault the officers.
Correct. We started tracking it in 2008 under Brian Lowry. We started tracking it by asking the locals, send me your information, because the agency used to put that information out, but they quit doing it because we were using it to show people what was really happening when we would go and talk to congressmen to try to tell them how dangerous these places were becoming. They didn't believe us. So we started tracking the information for ourselves. And that's what we've done over the past 5 years. And that's the data that we have is actual data. But because someone doesn't get murdered or someone doesn't get killed or whatever, it's, they try to sweep it under the rug. But we keep the statistics to show our congressmen that, hey, you know, we still are in a dangerous situation, because when you add the 39% more people coming into these institutions, you increase that possibility that they make shanks or get a hold of material that they could make shanks out of. And they are very creative with whatever they can find. And that's the problem, because we got more people doing it and less people to watch them.
So, Dale, then what did the report recommend in terms of fixing some of these problems, particularly with the overcrowding?
Well, there's a number of things that were mentioned. Sentencing guidelines, which that has been addressed, but I don't know how far it can really go because we're dealing with violent offenders. More prisons, which would cost millions and millions. Programs which would reduce recidivism, and also reentry programs which would give these people job skills to where they could have a a future outside. However, with that much overcrowding and less staff, it's difficult to work these programs when you don't have the people to do it. So, you know, all of the recommendations, we can do a little bit of all of that. But really, the reentry program that's been promoted by the agency, it's going to be hard to achieve or to be successful when you're using those people that actually do that work to cover correctional posts, because we don't have the funding or the amount of officers we need to cover this kind of overcrowding. We have housing units within housing units, that have to be patrolled and looked at, whereas not normally the officer can see most of the activity in the housing unit. Now they have them in these corners and in these other buildings and in TV rooms and what have you, which are away from the main area. And those are areas that we have to go in and patrol and leave the main area not monitored. So it becomes difficult. It's just, I don't know the answer. It can't be fixed today, but some of the things they addressed have to be addressed in the near future.
Do you think that maybe things could be looking up for you all here, knowing that at least GAO has taken a hard look at this, and maybe in combination with some of the progress that your council has made recently? I'm thinking along the lines of the pilot pepper spray program. Do you think that some of these issues that you've been pushing for years are finally getting the attention it deserves?
Absolutely. We work diligently to let the people know what's really happening. We've worked diligently with Congress to educate them. We've invited them to come into the prisons. AFGE has helped us on the Hill with the congressmen and the legislators when we talk about budgets and how it affects what we do and what we can do and what we can't do because of the lack of it. Yes, absolutely. The more we can educate the public and those congressmen that can give us the funding, absolutely, the better off we'll be. It's not that we're asking for something that we don't need. We're asking for people to realize what the needs are, or we're going to pay for it in the end. You know, it's no commercial. You can pay me now, or you can pay me later. And that's what we're trying to avoid, major uprisings behind this overcrowding, because these people get frustrated as well. And when they get frustrated with each other, you know, then we have trouble, and it's hard to contain it at the levels where we are.
Dale Desotel, the president of AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. Dale, thanks for taking the time to join us today, and stay safe, okay?
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll take you back to the Democratic National Convention with AFGE National President J. David Cox.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab, or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by J. David Cox, AFGE's National President. President Cox, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Jason. Glad to be here.
Our interview today is certainly different than ones that we've had in the past. We are, of course, attending the Democratic National Convention here in Charlotte, North Carolina, not far from your hometown of Kannapolis, North Carolina. Tell me what you've seen and done so far.
Jason, it's just been a great experience. I arrived here Sunday, had a reception Sunday night with the Maryland delegation, just certainly getting to meet the folks from Maryland, Monday morning, the Maryland delegation has a regular meeting each morning of the convention. I was the Labor Day speaker for the Maryland delegation, which was very exciting for me. President Emeritus of AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, was there, so it was a real honor to be able to speak to the folks in Maryland, which is now my home state, originally North Carolina was, and to talk about the importance of the labor movement, and was able to share with the group that AFG is in the final stages of finalizing a contract for TSA, which was one of the largest union victories in the last year that's been held in this country.
Of course, the TSA contract is monumental on a number of levels, but it speaks to the issue of collective bargaining, which is something that has been brought up here as a platform at the DNC. Tell us about that.
Clearly, Jason, I think a very distinctive difference in the Democratic platform versus the Republican platform. The Democratic platform emphasizes the rights of workers to engage in collective bargaining, to form and join unions. The Republican platform basically is against the right of collective bargaining and has very, very strong feelings about government employees, be it local, state, or federal employees, having the right to collectively bargain over the working conditions and conditions of employment.
Talk about how collective bargaining has changed your life, not only as a federal employee, but as a union leader.
Clearly, I mean, when employees have the right to stand together and bargain a contract, that's a document, that's a legal binding document that people enter into that affects the working conditions, their improved working conditions. There's a grievance procedure. There's nothing wrong with having grievances and workplace disputes. There's something wrong when you don't have procedures to resolve workplace disputes or the ability then to go to a neutral third party to make a decision that's binding upon the parties. And that's what we have when we have collective bargaining. It makes for a better life. It's having worked in the private sector for years before I went to work for the VA, clearly I understand the value of having a union in the workplace.
In terms of the TSA contract, how will that change the working lives of the officers who basically guard the skies?
Yeah, clearly. And they are the first line of defense for this country, Jason. Everyone needs to think about that regular reoccurring. They are the ones that protect us as flying public. But I would remind everyone, aircraft fly over the entire country. They can go anywhere and create damage and havoc, just as they did on 9/11, 11 years ago. So the fact of this contract, though, looking at that, there's clauses and procedures how employees will bid for shifts and for particular work areas, how they will schedule their annual leave and have days off. There will be some rotation processes, how you distribute overtime, uniform allowances, parking, all those things that are major, major issues in everyone's work environment. Those are things we've addressed in this contract.
Let's talk a little bit more about your time here at the Democratic National Convention. You are, of course, a delegate for the state of Maryland. What were your roles and responsibilities be in that position?
As a delegate, the delegates have the access to the floor. Obviously, we're going to adopt the platform. We are going to renominate Barack Obama for, the Democratic Party for re-election as President of the United States. So those procedures are pretty routine and will occur automatically on the floor. But delegates, there's a great deal of networking. You meet with all the members of Congress and the Senate. There's all the major players, veterans organizations, other labor unions, other people with causes that's important to our union and to federal employees. So it's a great opportunity to meet with folks, have those conversations and discussions, as well as influence people and to get out the message about the good work that federal employees and D.C. government workers do every day of their lives for the American public.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with AFGE National President J. David Cox President Cox, where do you think we are in the history of the labor movement today? I know it's hard to predict the future, but where do you think we are in terms of labor's history?
I believe that labor is at some crucial times. There is no secret that the number of union members has been going down in this country. I believe, though, that workers are realizing that the ability to have a union is an important thing. I also believe labor is realizing that they have to get out of the box, do things as AFGE did with organizing TSA that did not have the right to collective bargaining, that could not have a contract at that time. The bottom line, they wanted to be a member of a union. They wanted, they set that as a goal. We organized them. They joined our union. They got involved. So there are many ways to organize workers. And I shared with the Maryland delegation Monday morning as I spoke on Labor Day. There's been a lot of concern from organized labor about the convention being in Charlotte and the fact that North Carolina is a very poorly organized union state. But if you want more union members, I tell other unions, go to North Carolina and organize them. AFGE is the largest affiliate of AFL-CIO in North Carolina because we organize in North Carolina. And I encourage other unions to organize. UAW has organized workers in North Carolina. Other unions have done that. So, you know, I believe very strongly in organize, organize, organize. And that was President Trumka's message this morning at the AFL-CIO, that all of us need to be out organizing more workers and giving workers the benefits of union contracts.
On that notion of thinking outside the box, my memory serves correctly, it was said early on in the TSA creation that organizing or getting them union protections couldn't be done.
You're exactly correct, Jason, and that we went a very long period of time, and it was clear that, you know, no one was going to budge over that, but still yet there was regulations, there was laws, there was procedures in place, and AFGE very successfully represented the employees, but most of all advocated on a national level for a change in legislation, a change in legislative rules or in administrative rules inside the administration.
I imagine that this event in this location at this time is very personal for you. You are the new president at AFGE. You're a delegate from the state of Maryland. You were born in North Carolina. It's happening just around Labor Day, which obviously means so much to you. Tell me about some of the personal emotions that you feel
it
being here.
It doesn't get much better than this, Jason. It just does not get much better than this. 2012, I have to say, has been a spectacular year in my personal life. Obviously, being elected by the AFG membership to serve as their president for the next 3 years, to come to Charlotte, an area that I grew up in, for the Democratic National Convention, and to be a part of the reelection of Barack Obama and Joe Biden to be the leaders of this country. I'm looking very forward to the future, and I'm very excited about the year that I've been experiencing.
As we get through the rest of this week, what are you hoping to see coming out of this? What's one thing that you would like to see done or a decision made that would sort of catapult the party into November?
Excitement. There's been a lot of conversations today, and as it was in the press over the weekend, about the fact of, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And I had to think about that, and I would say, yes, I am. I have seen the labor movement grow. I've seen AFGE grow. I have seen us have great appointees to the FLRA, the NLRB, and other labor boards. I have seen many other issues. I've seen the administration step up to the plate and support collective bargaining. I've also seen a pay freeze on the cost of living adjustment for federal employees. And federal employees have stepped up to the plate and took that hit and understanding that it was a big hit, but we are also standing very firm that federal employees have done their fair share, and we call upon the 1% of this country that's paying less than everyone else to pay their fair share. So I view a lot of good things. I believe we're all better off than we were 4 years ago. This country was on the brink of financial disaster. People's homes were being lost. We were losing jobs continuously. There has been a change in the number of jobs that's been created. Less foreclosures. The stock market is changing. If you look at all the statistical data, yes, there has been improvement. Is there a ways to go? There's clearly a ways to go. But yes, we are better off than we were 4 years ago.
As we close out here, what is at stake for federal employees in this upcoming election?
Their very existence. You've got one party that's basically saying federal employees have to go away, that the private sector does it better, and all federal work should be contracted out. And another party saying, yes, federal employees, through their unions, do a great job in servicing the American public, and the collective bargaining is good. So, I mean, there is very clear two distinctive differences in the platforms of the two parties.
J. David Cox, AFGE's national president. President Cox, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much, Jason.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue from the Democratic National Convention with Save the Children's Senior Vice President, Mark Shriver.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Mark Shriver, the Senior Vice President of Save the Children's U.S. Programs, as well as the son of Sergeant Shriver. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's start first with what you're doing here this week at the Democratic National Convention here in Charlotte.
Well, you know, Save the Children's been working in the United States for almost 80 years, trying to help kids that are living in poverty, and I run all of their U.S. programs. It's really amazing that most folks don't know that almost one in four kids, that's almost 25% of the kids in the United States, are living in poverty. So Save the Children works in those communities, teaching literacy skills to kids, not only in first, second, and third grade, but getting them prepared to enter kindergarten ready to learn, so those crucial first 5 years of life. And as a country, we unfortunately have not made the investment in early childhood education that we should be making. When you look at it, particularly juxtapose it to India and China, you see that those governments have plans. China in particular has a plan that by 2020, they're going to double the number of kids in early childhood education. In the United States, almost 60% of the kids don't get early childhood education. So they're entering kindergarten not ready to learn. And we want to talk about that and hope that both political parties make kids a priority.
This might sound like a redundant question, but with the statistic that you gave that 25% of our children live in poverty, how important is it to start early and get children the education and the care that they need?
It's crucial. You know, almost 25% of the kids are living in poverty. It's not at 25. It may actually be over now. Those stats are about a year old. But what you see is for young kids, the first 5 years of life, it's about 90% of your brain growth happens in those first 5 years of life. And studies have shown that a kid that's 4 years old living in poverty is 18 months behind developmentally behind my kid. So it's really crucial that we get in and provide those additional resources, particularly to poor families, so that they enter kindergarten ready to learn. Or else we're going to be spending billions of dollars in remediation, which is what we're doing now. trying to get those kids caught up through elementary school and get them ready for high school. And for too many of these kids, if they're not reading a grade level by the end of third grade, they're going to have a really hard time graduating from elementary and high school.
You mentioned a number of other countries who are prepping kids earlier in life, particularly one of our main rivals, of course, China. What's one thing that you would like to see done now to get kids up to speed?
Well, I think, you know, China has a plan that by 2020 they're going to provide 70% of the kids with 3 years of early childhood preschool services. They're going to more than double the enrollment in higher education. They have a plan. The United States does not. The Obama administration has invested $500 million through the Race to the Top funding, in early childhood education. But that's really a drop in the bucket when you look at the overall need in this country. So I wish that as a country, both on a federal and state level, we had a plan to get kids prepared to enter kindergarten ready to learn so that we won't fall further behind China than we already are.
You, of course, were a longtime member of Maryland's House of Delegates. What were some actions that the state of Maryland took to ensure that children were getting the education they needed?
Well, I was the chair of the Joint Committee on Children, Youth, and Families, and we brought all of the state secretaries in front of us to testify and find out whether all of the state and federal money that we were investing, whether we were preparing our kids to enter kindergarten ready to learn. And at that point in Maryland's history, which is 1999, we didn't even know whether kids were entering kindergarten ready to learn. I mean, can you believe that? We were spending tens and hundreds of millions of dollars, federal and state, and didn't even know whether kids were ready to go into kindergarten. So we set up a system where those kids would be evaluated, and where their kids were struggling the most, the schools, the child care centers that they were struggling in, we put additional resources in there to get the training up to speed so that those teachers and preschool teachers were doing a better job with those kids. We also set up a system of evaluation where child care centers are graded in this state, and resources are put in to better educate child care center workers so they do a better job educating our kids. So Maryland took a bunch of steps in the late 90s and into 2000 on this issue, following really the lead of North Carolina and Governor Hunt.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Mark Shriver, the Senior Vice President of Save the Children's U.S. Programs. Clearly, this is an important issue that needs to be dealt with in our country. Let's talk about how this issue factors into the presidential campaign. How do you see the Obama administration differing, if at all, from a Romney-Ryan ticket that might tackle this issue as well?
Well, I think, you know, clearly President Obama has put money in through Race to the Top funds to focus in on early childhood education, and that's obviously to his credit. You know, the Ryan budget that passed the House, put in a reduction in the food funding program of 17% for our kids. You know, we've lost over 300,000 local education jobs since the recession ended in June of 2009. I think, you know, neither the administration nor a potential Romney-Ryan administration has talked enough about the importance of early childhood education. They haven't talked enough about poor kids and poor families in this country. I think both parties need to do more on that front. Clearly, President Obama has taken steps in the right directions, but there are steps that need more work in that area.
Let's shift gears for a minute. In addition to, of course, your work at Save the Children, you also are an author and have written a book about your father, Sergeant Shriver, titled A Good Man. Tell me about the book and give us some insight into what your dad was like.
Well, you know, I wrote the book after he died. So many people told me he was a good man as compared to a great man. A lot of folks, you know, in the newspapers and television said he was a great man for having created the Peace Corps, having run President Johnson's War on Poverty, creating Head Start, Legal Services for the Poor, Job Corps, Foster Grandparents, VISTA. But I wanted to understand how he did all of that and was happily married for 56 years, raised 5 kids, went to Mass every day of his life, didn't ever exclude folks, whether they were Republicans or Democrats, whether they were Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or Muslims. He wanted to really work with people to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, and to shelter the homeless. And I wanted to figure out how he did that with such joy. And that's really what the book is about. It's about his son trying to figure out what made his father tick, what gave him so much energy, which helped him to survive, you know, to live through the last 10 years of his life when he battled Alzheimer's and ultimately lost that battle at the age of 95. The book has done great, made the New York Times bestseller list and made it to number 1 on the Washington Post list. So I'm really proud and happy of that. But I think there's so much that people like me and my wife who are raising young kids and dealing with aging parents can learn from my dad.
Give me a story about your dad during a time in your younger years, during your formative years as a young person. What's a story about your dad that stood out to you?
Well, it's the one my brother Bobby told at the funeral, and that I related in the book about him, my brother Bobby, getting arrested when he was 16 for smoking pot. My father was thinking of running for president. My Uncle Bobby had just died a couple of months earlier. And everybody was telling Bobby what a disaster he was. And my dad called him into his room and said, look, you have to be accountable for this, but you're a good kid. This is going to work out. And he just gave him unconditional love. And he forgave him. And he knew that what was more important, his child's future, and whether making sure that that kid knew he was loved and supported, was more important than any impact it could have on his political career. And I think he always felt that his kids and his family and what they were doing and helping other people was more important than whether he got elected vice president with McGovern in 72, which they obviously got lost that race, or when he ran for president in 76. But he didn't care, I don't think, ultimately about those losses, because he was the next day excited about the next opportunity.
That story makes me wonder, is that part of the reason or maybe a catalyst for getting you so involved in the development of young people in your own life?
I think so. I mean, he's a wonderful role model. I mean, here's a guy that played on the national and international stage, did great things, so people say, but more importantly was good to the waitresses at his favorite restaurant who waited in line to tell me he was a good man at the wake. The guy at the U.S. Air counter who told me the exact same thing. So he had, friendships with President Clinton and Biden and members of both parties. Governor Romney's father, George Romney, was, a big supporter of VISTA, Volunteers in Service to America. So he went on both sides of the aisle, but most importantly, he was a great father. He was a good father and, cared about his kids. So I think, I'm struggling with that. I'm not doing it as well as he is, but I'm trying to do it not only in our home, but also in the work that I do to try to make a difference for people and for kids.
As we close out here today, what are you most looking forward to this week at the Democratic National Convention?
I'm hoping that there's a lot of chatter about kids. I'm hoping there's a lot of chatter about the fact that one in four kids in this country lives in poverty. I don't think there's going to be as much as there should be, so I'm going to keep pushing on that front. And I'm looking forward to going home, seeing my own wife and kids when this is over. But thanks for having me on.
Aren't we all? Mark Shriver, the Senior Vice President of Save the Children's U.S. Programs. Mark, thank you for your time and your commitment to this country's young people.
Thanks a million. Really appreciate it.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll finish up our coverage of the Democratic National Convention with former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Wiener.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by one of our very good friends here, Bob Wiener, former Clinton White House spokesman as well as a national Democratic strategist. Bob, welcome back to the program.
It's such a pleasure to be with you, Jason. You are the most substantive of all the radio people that are in this huge building, and so I really enjoy talking with you periodically.
I appreciate that, Bob. And, of course, this huge building is the Time Warner Cable Arena at the Democratic National Convention. Tell me what you're doing here and how many hats are you possibly wearing this week?
Well, I'm a surrogate for the president and for the campaign, was on Fox and Friends yesterday taking the punchings, but punching back, I think, about as hard as they were trying to punch me, and we can talk about that. It was a lot of fun. And doing some radio, I also am running the Daily Press briefing room for the convention. And it's a bit exhausting to do both, but I'm having a lot of fun because this is an opportunity to get a great message out.
tell our listeners, our audience, what happens in this daily press briefing room. I don't think many people know the ins and outs of what goes on there.
Well, the first day was an open news conference with 20 cameras and 200 media all on the message and the logistics of the convention, going over the podium schedule of the speakers, which today, for example, are going to range right through Michelle Obama, and then tomorrow include President Clinton, and then, of course, President Obama and Vice President Biden the final day, and then a whole host of actors and leaders in the party and up-and-comers like Elizabeth Warren and so forth. So it's a great convention to spotlight rising and current Democratic stars and the issues and the platform that we talked about today in the press briefing that is extremely important, shows the difference between the Democrats going middle out and the Republicans going top down, which caused the crash in the first place, let alone the women's choice and self-deportation and cutting student loans and all the other issues that they would be a disaster, cutting Medicare and Social Security. But their philosophy of top-down instead of middle-out is a disaster for Americans.
Explain what you mean by top-down versus middle-out. Give our listeners a sense for what that means and what the impact is on their lives.
It's direct impact. Top-down is trickle-down, and everybody knows that trickle-down is what Herbert Hoover did, which means tax breaks for the rich and benefits for the rich, thinking they will create jobs. Didn't work for Herbert Hoover, and hey, it worked real well under the Bush administration, causing the crash, and unfortunately, the Democrats compromised and included in the stimulus, 40% of it is tax cuts, and we've agreed to the tax cut philosophy, and it hasn't worked real well even now. So trickle down is not the way to go, and that's top down, thinking that the rich will create jobs instead of investing their money in the residuals of their company and buying yachts and getting putting their money in offshore bank accounts in the Caymans and the Bahamas and making tons of money for themselves. It doesn't work. It's proven that it doesn't work, and we keep hearing how you got to help the job creators. Well, of course you do, except the job creators are the people who do the work. Those are the job creators. And Democrats who've done people programs have had a 5.5% GDP growth, 5.5% under Democratic presidents since Hoover. Since Hoover, Republican presidents with their tax breaks philosophy, 1.5% GDP growth. That's an op-ed I did, Jason, in the Miami Herald. So it's case closed, proven that the tax breaks for the rich and the philosophy of trickle down and top down is a disaster for the American economy, for American workers, and for the people of America who have the programs like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, food stamps, student loans, and housing and everything else that matters in our country, and infrastructure and our bridges, which 40% are unsafe now. We're not doing them because of top down, the rich have the money.
One of the things that you mentioned here was people who do the work, which reminds me very, very much of AFGE members who are federal and D.C. government employees in federal service, something that you know about spending a good part of your career as a federal employee.
Well, I've loved my federal service, and yes, we do the work, we do public service. Federal employees are just denigrated and criticized and used as punching bags, and it really bothers me because, as you know, Jason, with all the wonderful members of your union, federal employees are dedicated and chose that career and know, by the way, that you're making a lot less than you would make in the private sector doing the same job if you were in business. But we've chosen to give in public service. And I've worked for some great people, for Claude Pepper, Ed Koch, Ted Kennedy, Charlie Rangel, although I hide a little bit under my desk with his ethics problems. But he's always fought for the poor and the oppressed. John Conyers. And in the Clinton administration, Lee Brown, Barry McCaffrey. So I've had the real privilege of working for some incredible national leaders. And to me, it's a travesty when any federal employee or elected official suddenly becomes a money-motivated person and takes some kind of a bribe. That is a rare breed of some kind that does that, because most of the people, and I say I did the exception of Rangel, who didn't have a sense, he got into arrogance somewhat, but they've been so dedicated to helping people, and that's the whole reason for their public service lives.
And dedicated to something that is much, much bigger than themselves.
That's right.
That reflects their attitudes on their country and their fellow countrymen. And I think of a situation really we're sitting right next to here, your lovely wife, Pat, who has done a phenomenal job.
Right, and Dr. Patricia Berg, for those who need to know.
and a lot of research to help people live better, healthier lives.
She's a cancer researcher. We're so proud of her, discovering a gene activated in 80% of women with breast cancer, 70% of men with prostate cancer, trying to discover, she's working on it, and close to a blood test, working on a suppressor. Grants from Avon, Komen, DOD, NIH, and the Susan Love Foundation, and a host of others that help her because they recognize her work. And she's been on CNN, Washington Post, New York Times as a spokesperson, and had 16 cameras at her news conference announcing her discovery, more than Dick Cheney had in the same hospital that Pat's a professor at when he was sick. So we're very proud of Pat. But, you know, the point about public service is I am disgusted at the Republicans now who don't make it about government and the country, and they make it about, as Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, said, about obstructing the President of the United States. What kind of an attitude is that? You know, I go through when I've been in the White House and Congress on Social Security, Medicare, you study them, and I did a piece in Roll Call, it just so bothers me that instead of the 60 to 90 opposition votes that we always used to get, that now you get zero despite the compromises. And the myth, for example, of Obama's not compromising on the health care bill when he gave 160 amendments to the Republicans, including small business tax breaks, and doing it through the private sector instead of as a single-payer bill. That was a compromise, doing it through the private sector instead of the far better way that other countries do of a single-payer. So we compromised in order that people have the benefits, but we did not get any support whatsoever from Republicans. So that's what public service should be, by the way, is bipartisanship and working together, and it's unfortunately not happening now.
These issues of the Affordable Care Act, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, these are issues that you're very well versed in and you've spent a lot of time researching. Tell me how the Affordable Care Act changes an everyday middle-class average American.
Well, the great Claude Pepper, who was my chairman when I was the chief of staff of the House Aging Committee, would roll over in his grave if he saw the cuts that are being proposed in Social Security and Medicare now, because they have both stopped poverty among the seniors. 50% of poverty is stopped by Social Security and 25% is stopped by Medicare. If you cut those programs, you voucherize it, you make them pay $6,000 more, you raise the age of eligibility, any way you want to cut the program and call it reform. It's not reform. It's cutting, slicing, and dicing the programs and stopping health care. You are adding to poverty in America, and you'll have to pay at the other end of it for health care, for emergency services, for food stamps, for housing, every which way. Because, by the way, half of all bankruptcies are caused from a health care illness in this country, half. And so it's the largest cause of bankruptcy that we have in America.
You actually bring up a very good point about paying for it on the back end, or
that's
paying
right
for it later. You know, I don't think that a lot of people really consider that. Looking at a situation, you might look at it in the short term, but you're saying, hey, take a look at it through the entire life cycle.
That's right.
Of it.
I have an op-ed, and I hope our listeners go to my website, wienerpublic.com, W-E-I-N-E-R, public.com. I'm very open. I put everything up there, including, if you click on op-eds, all the op-eds. In the Tallahassee Democrat, Medicare cuts will cost the nation. A huge headline that they made of it across the whole top of the paper in one of Florida's top five papers. And so I'm very aggressive about that issue, and I make the point all the time. And the same thing is true on Social Security. You start tampering with cutting Social Security benefits, and you're going to start having to pay for all those other programs, because that's an insurance. And by the way, seniors have paid into it, and it's solvent for 30 more years. And it's a myth to say there's no Social Security surplus. There is, for 30 years and counting. There have already been 15 individual years since 1965 where Social Security has had a temporary deficit, and it's been picked up by the trust fund. There's no trust fund? Yes, there is. The seniors have paid their insurance premiums into the federal government. It's like any other bank. Try telling a bank, oh, we've used your money for other programs. Sorry, we won't give it to you. Try that sometime. It's under law that the federal government owes you the money and has to make up the difference, even if there's a shortage in the Social Security benefit for one single year. For example, which they did a stupid thing of cutting the payroll tax takes it out of Social Security. But the law at least says that the federal government has to make that up.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Bob Wiener, former Clinton White House spokesman and a national Democratic strategist. Bob, on this issue of Social Security, tell me what you think happens to the standard of living in this country if Social Security is either cut or just simply dissolved.
Well, I want to point out that it's very important, Jason, that people not listen to the rhetoric of when the Republicans say we're reforming Social Security, we're reforming Medicare, they mean cut. Translate reform to cut. Translate reform to kill so the program is not what you know. Education has to happen here. It's completely a myth when they say, we're protecting Social Security by the Republicans. It's a lie. Their campaign has been built on a tripod of lies. They are cutting Social Security. And that means if they cut Social Security and Medicare, you go back to the days, literally, when you had 75% of seniors in poverty and they went to trash cans and ate dog food. That actually is what happened before the New Deal in the Great Depression. And if we want to do that, go cut seniors' programs. Where are they going to go for their meals, for often their very basic housing that they've moved into because they've already sold their home? Where are they going to go?
Who's out there advocating on behalf of seniors?
I will say Democrats more than Republicans in the generic, but I also put an op-ed out saying we need Claude Pepper's courage now. When he was the chairman of the House Aging Committee, Juanita Kreps, who was the Carter administration, Pepper didn't care which party, Commerce Secretary, said, oh, we ought to raise the age maybe from 65 to 67. And Pepper looked at that and he said, over my dead body. And he rolled in Jim Burke, who was the chairman. Pepper was the chairman of the Aging Committee. Jim Burke was the chairman of the Social Security Subcommittee. And we traipsed over to Juanita Kreps' office. And Pepper said to her, I will fight this to the death. And Burke said, so will I. And Juanita Kreps then said, oh, it wasn't a real proposal anyway. It was just a thought. And that's how you do it. We need that courage now. President Obama has been very good. He has said that Social Security does not have a short-term deficit. I actually raised the question in a White House news conference to Jack Lew, and he said his response, because I was trying to get him to get to the point of saying that there's no short-term benefit, it's only a long-term minor problem. And that's what he said. President Obama had a news conference the next day, and apparently Jack Lew had briefed him and said the very same thing. So we've got the president saying exactly the right thing. What you have the Republicans saying is cut now. And they're also saying we're not going to cut seniors. We're only going to cut people under 55. Well, that's ageist to the hilt in creating an age warfare, but it's also nonsense because, first of all, do you think Granny doesn't want her grandson to have the same Social Security she does? Of course she does. That's number one. Number two is because they want to cut Obamacare, they call it, which now President Obama has taken as a pride factor. Great, he did it. He brought in covering seniors' drugs, the donut hole, the between $2,500 and $4,500 unexplainable gap that they used to have to pay, now they will have covered, in addition to lifetime benefits, so that when they get cancer, your insurance company doesn't drop you, so that your kids can be on your plan until they're age 26, and then you have preventive care. And, by the way, the insurance companies have to provide 80% of what they take in as benefits, not profit to them. They're only entitled to 20% profit, so that now people are getting $500 checks from their insurance companies saying that we're required by President Obama's new health care law to give you this check because we charged you too much. And when I talked to an airline attendant who I was talking to about the provisions of the bill, who had thought the bill was bad, and when I explained what the provisions of the bill were, the airline attendant said, gee, that's a good bill. If I knew what's in the bill, I could support it. Well, that's the point. It's national health insurance that helps the people of America for the first time get to where other countries were.
As we close out here, I know you have a couple of other shows to do, but I want to get one last thing from you. Are you having just as much fun this time as you did the first time you've been here?
I am. And I love it, and I really appreciate your having me on. We've had a lot of fun, Jason. I really appreciate your having me on, and thank you so much.
Bob Wiener, our good friend, former Clinton White House spokesman, as well as a national Democratic strategist. Bob, always great to have you on the program.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you to our guests this week, AFGE National President J. David Cox, Council of Prison Locals President Dale Desotel, Save the Children Senior Vice President Mark Shriver, and former Clinton White House spokesman Bob Wiener. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you by the American Federation of Government Employees. Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.